From SavannahNow.com and the Savannah Morning News, this is The Commute, a thrice-weekly podcast focused on Savannah-centric news and issues. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, and today is Wednesday, April the 15th. In a normal year, this would be Income Tax Day, and we'd find some tax-related topic to discuss. But alas, the coronavirus has led to a filing extension. So instead of talking taxes, we're going to talk about more fascinating subjects, specifically nonprofits and how they are dealing with the COVID-19 crush. We'll also squeeze in some sports talk as well. The Commute is presented by National Office Systems. Thank you for thumbing up The Commute on this rainy Wednesday. Today's episode features interviews with Bryn Grant of the United Way of the Coastal Empire, which has ramped up its already robust community assistance efforts in the face of the pandemic. And for you sports fans, the Associated Press's Paul Newberry calls in to help us mourn all the lost games and golf rounds and share some thoughts on what to expect in the sports world in the months ahead once the coronavirus threat subsides. But first, as we do each day, we remind you, the audience, about the work done by our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Many of us are getting to the point where we can't wait to get back into our offices. Working from home can be great. Well, for a while. Once we do head back to HQ, you may look around your space and realize it's time for a refresh. That's where National Office Systems can help. Owner Scott Center and his team have been offering office solutions to businesses and schools in Savannah since the 1980s. And through a partnership with Dirt Modular Interiors, which manufactures configurable walls and furnishings at a facility right here in Savannah, National Office Systems can help you reimagine a more functional and productive office space. Learn more about National Office Systems and how they can elevate your workspace using Dirt products by visiting natoffsys.com. Again, that's natoffsys.com. Now, here's the interview with the United Way of the Coastal Empire director, Bryn Grant. Pleased to be joined on the Commute podcast today by the United Way of the Coastal Empire's Bryn Grant. Bryn is new to the United Way, not new to Savannah, obviously. Most folks remember her as in her role over at CETA for many, many years and other places before that, the forerunner to the music festival and so on, but she moved over to United Way in early February and was just getting her feet wet when the pandemic breaks loose. And when a pandemic breaks loose and people are suddenly in need, the United Way kind of kicks into higher gear. And Bryn, let's start there. Can you kind of talk about what you've seen in terms of how things have ramped up in the last couple of weeks and how your organization has responded to it?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me, Adam. So it got very intense very, very quickly. And it has been every single day since the moment we understood what was coming and happening, which I would guess my full appreciation began like the, you know, maybe around March 12th or 13th. That week, at least the week that the discussion of canceling the St. Patrick's Day parade and all of that. And we immediately knew that with those kinds of decisions that businesses were going to be impacted dramatically and that people would be laid off and or businesses would close and that resources were going to be needed. We weren't even exactly sure of the details, and I guess that's true every single day. You know, every day this has been an evolving experience, and things have continued to change and evolve. But we knew we were going to need resources to direct through our 211 call center and in our county services offices to people to prevent what we hope to prevent what could be really catastrophic, life-changing situations. And in particular, I think we have seen a high demand on food needs for food distribution, and there's a great infrastructure with Second Harvest and Senior Citizens Meals on Wheels programs and Manna House in Liberty County and many others that are getting food to people who need it. And there are a lot more people who need it than might need it otherwise throughout the year that are needing it now in these circumstances. So we're able to refer through 211, through our community service centers, people to resources that can help them, whether that's assistance with filling out, applying for different government programs with Step Up, whether that is assistance with homeschooling or programs to keep your children interested. I mean, you name it, and we have a database online that people can access for information, and we're updating that regularly. And so when people call, we're often using that database to refer them to the programs and services through our nonprofits, through other organizations throughout the region that can help them. But for us, the biggest demand has been for housing assistance, people who need help to stay in secure, safe housing. Not everyone, many of the landlords that, own properties are not big, enormous corporations that can afford to allow grace periods. They need that income to support their families. So that has been the greatest need, and we are receiving literally thousands of calls, and we have hundreds of applications that we're trying to process. And I'll say that typically our staff is three full-time people and one part-time person. And that, that's solid for us throughout the year with about 300 calls a week. And that's just at 211, not in our county service centers where, they take direct calls for assistance all the time. We try to direct the needs to our nonprofit agencies. That's what they're for. That's why we invest in them with the funds that are raised each year to maintain that social services infrastructure. And but this is a situation where there's a giant gap, and we're all stepping in to try and fill it in as creative a way and as effective a way and as responsible a way as we can.
As that volume picks up, your staff is not growing with that volume, but you are getting people to step up and fill in. Can you kind of talk about the volunteers and how they've stepped forward over the last couple of weeks?
Well, I'll say that it's actually been a little difficult in some cases. So our volunteer leadership has stepped in many ways. So those who serve on our board and serve on committees like community investment or marketing or resource development, they are contributing to thinking. They are developing and working with us on our policies and how we might, for example, make our awards to the United Way agencies more flexible in this unique time for our agencies to use in ways that wouldn't otherwise, be appropriate or considered, or looking at guidelines for an emergency fund for agencies, looking at best practices and best ways we can get information out through marketing. So they're really have been very active, even though it's all been remote. And that's something new to many of us, not everyone, but to many of us, that's been very new, but they've been very active. On the other side, engaging volunteers to help take calls has been difficult because we have a certain system, a phone system that maybe limits access to some. But what we have done is we have cross-trained a number of our staff. About 9 or 10 of our staff members are supporting 211 now, which was necessary. And you probably read or saw that some of the agencies that we work with have stepped in to help process applications. So that is happening. And those are usually, I'm not sure if you or I would be qualified, frankly, Adam, to take those calls. It really is people with certain knowledge about the social services systems and people who are able to take that caller from beginning to end, hopefully through a process, dealing with their situation on a case-by-case basis. So it is a little bit specialized from that perspective.
We've seen some donors step up as well. I was very impressed that last week we saw the Savannah Community Foundation had made a contribution to the United Way that is $50,000 total, but the second $25,000 was basically saying it was a matching grant. It said, if you raise $25,000 from independently of us, we'll give you another $25,000. If you raise $10,000 independently of us, we'll only give you $10,000. You guys surpassed that in a week. Can you kind of talk about the generosity you're seeing amongst people in town?
It's really remarkable, and we were extremely grateful for the engagement of the Savannah Community Foundation. They reached out to us for information, and very soon after came back with this idea and this gift, and it was exciting, and we were sincerely grateful. Again, I think you and I may have spoken about this a bit before, that there is such what I've experienced so far in my short but feels like a long time at United Way through the circumstance. What I'm experiencing is that the United Way is an organization that was created by the community for the community, and I always knew that. But now that I've been in this place and in this role, I can see and appreciate even more, and certainly so much more deeply, that the ownership this community has for this organization and the role it plays in the community. They really, really support it and feel like it's theirs, which is, gosh, what more could you hope for with everybody feeling ownership, then everybody steps in to do their part. And certainly the Savannah Community Foundation has done that. And we're having conversations, nearly every day with either an individual donor or a corporate donor who is either, considering how they will make a contribution to this fund, recognizing that it is an unprecedented situation we find ourselves in. And even if they are donors to our annual fund and our annual campaign, that this is an exceptional circumstance, and dollars are needed now, maybe more than ever, for this need.
And that brings up something that I know people in the nonprofit community are whispering a lot about, and they don't want to really talk about it now because they're hip deep in this situation. They want to focus on this situation. But looking down the road, when this passes, the economy is probably not going to roar back, and people are going to be watching their profit and loss statements and their checkbooks and what have you, and are probably going to be potentially less likely to donate. How much of a deal is that for you all, and what do you do to maybe keep those people engaged and make sure that the nonprofits remain successful and front and center here in town?
I am cautiously optimistic. I think I'm by nature an optimistic person, and then you can't be my age and not also be cautious. If you've lived a while, you've experienced enough disappointments to add some realism to your optimism. But I think, I saw early on in this a letter that our Georgia Association of United Ways, a board member from one of those United Ways in Georgia, shared. And in it, he expressed that he felt like, ultimately, as difficult as all of this is, and as challenging, that he hoped and believed that we will come out of this with a greater understanding for the need for and support of our nonprofit communities. Mm-hmm. That it's those nonprofits that are on the front lines all year long, every year, year after year, in good times and in bad, and that this only highlighted for everyone the reason we as a society and as communities need to invest in our nonprofits and need to support them. They are us. They are us. And they may not be, doing the same work as a private, industry, but we really cannot exist without each other. And we are, both doing work that's critical to the success of our society. So I hope that is true. And while it may be a little more difficult, and I would not even begin to speculate now what our campaign goals might look like in the fall, I still remain hopeful. I know I've been incredibly inspired by our nonprofit community, and I hope that donors are too.
Yeah, certainly. Right now, it appears that people are in the giving spirit more than ever. So hopefully, that will carry over. Before I let you go, I want to point people toward SavannahNow.com and toward the Thursday. I get my days confused right now. The Thursday edition. That's right. They're blending together. We have a column from Tim Morrissey, who is the chairman of United Way of the Coastal Empire's Community Investment Committee, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that's the committee that reviews all the different nonprofits and the applications and figures out where the money is best spent. And Tim has crafted a column that talks a lot about the various nonprofits in town, what they have done in recent weeks to step up, and kind of speaks to what we've been speaking about and how vital it is to continue to support these organizations and to support the United Way. And I appreciate you, Bryn, for helping facilitate that column, because I think it's very important for the people of Savannah to read that and see that and have a better understanding of it.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Bryn and her staff and volunteers at the United Way for all that they do. Before we move on to the sports sandbox and talk clubs, bats, balls, and the athletically gifted with Paul Newberry, I'd like to tell you a little bit about local journalism. On behalf of myself and the Savannah Morning News staff, I'd like to thank those readers who have sent us notes of encouragement in recent days and weeks. Our reporters are on the streets and working phones every day, bringing you local coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as everything else that's going on in and around town. If you value this journalism, now is the time to invest in it through a digital subscription to SavannahNow.com. We have an introductory offer that provides access for free for a month and then costs you just $7.99 a month for a year after that. Take advantage by visiting SavannahNow.com/digital-only offer. Again, that's SavannahNow.com/digital-only offer. Stay on top of all things local and support community journalism at the same time by becoming a subscriber to SavannahNow.com. Now, here's some sports talk with Paul Newberry.
I'm pleased to be joined on the commute now by Associated Press sports writer Paul Newberry, who covers all sports in Georgia and is kind enough to give us some time today. Before we hit the button, we taught them some theology and some other things. We're going to leave those conversations off the air.
Wise move, Mr. Adam.
And focus instead on some Georgia sports. And Paul, top of mind, of course, is Masters. Masters would have been last week. It has been pushed to November. I know that's something that you've done. You tell me, it probably at least the last 20 years in a row you've been over at Augusta National. What was last week like being home instead of at the media center at Augusta National?
Well, we did our best to improvise. My lovely wife, Linda, looked up and found a recipe for pimento cheese. So we had pimento cheese sandwiches that were pretty close to the original, but we had a few Arnold Palmers.
Okay.
And we had a two-hole putt-putt competition among ourselves, back and forth for four rounds. So, you know,
Who won that?
I did. I pulled it out.
Did you get a green jacket?
No, I got green beads. Green beads and our leftover greenery from St. Paddy's Day that we didn't use.
Oh,
so, yes. So I got Mardi Gras beads. So that was more appropriate for the quarantine Masters. But, it wasn't quite the same. I will say. It was missing a little something. So definitely was a strange – I mean, we're all living in strange – every day is a strange day. But, yes, it was a little – these last couple of weeks, especially with the Final Four that was here in Atlanta.
That's right, yes.
You know, that passing by, and that weekend, it was a gorgeous weekend. It would have been they were going to have concerts in Centennial Park and the great Saturday, with the two semifinals. So
the two games.
Yeah, these last couple of weeks with both Final Four and then this past week, would have been Masters week. Yes, it was strange, especially as you said, I have been covering it since the mid 90s. So,
okay.
It was odd indeed.
Right. And this, of course, would have been Tiger Woods would have been coming back as the defending champion. I'm going to make you go back 2 weeks. Would you have thought that Tiger Woods was the favorite coming into this one?
I would not have. I'm kind of sticking to my I'm hardly ever right, as most sports writers are not. But I did write a column a few years ago, you know, when he was, the injuries were piling up, and it sort of, you know, became obvious he was not going to catch Jack Nicklaus, you know, the 18, and I still don't think he will. But I kind of thought he had one more, you know. I said a great athlete like him, who's just been one of the, you know, one of the greats of all time for sure, you know, somehow always finds a way to summon it one more time. And Augusta seemed like the place where that would probably happen, because he's had so much success there and knows it so well. And it, you know, it plays into people who are, even though they've lengthened it, it's still so much experience and knowing where to hit the ball and where to miss. Yeah. And, you know, I thought he might have one more in him. So, you know, I kind of feel like last year sort of justified that. So I've got to kind of stick to, I'm not sure he'll win another. And, he had more injuries again. You know, that was, you know, that he was missing, you know, even before the shutdown. He obviously, you know, injuries had built up again. And for all of us who have gotten of a certain age, we realize that doesn't tend to get any better. You know, when things start breaking down, that's not a good sign, particularly for an athlete. And so I don't know if he has another one in him. I think I'd love to see it, because last year was one of the most electric things. You know, I thought it would be hard to ever come close to have been there in 97 when he won his first. Mm-hmm. But last year was might have been even more just dramatic because of what he had been through.
And moving.
I mean, it was
right.
Yes, and the first time he's ever rallied to come back, you know. It was just spectacular.
Beyond the delays, there was some interesting sports news in Georgia recently, and that Todd Gurley is coming home and going to play for the Falcons, and he's really only got one hamstring, we think, but it's still pretty exciting to see that move and see that in Atlanta, right?
Yeah, I think so. That was a little bit of a nice bit of news in the midst of all this, the homecoming of Todd Gurley. Not, you know, obviously not from here, but from, you know, for Georgia, Georgia fans, yes. And what he meant to Georgia. Now, you know, we'll see. Obviously, the Falcons, you know, with a one-year deal, are kind of like the rest of us. We'll have to see. You hope he can sort of be the Todd Gurley of old, but we also know that running backs tend to have a very short shelf life. And
yes.
This is a guy who's had a lot of injuries and has not been – you know, I remember that Super Bowl. We all remember when they were here in Atlanta a couple of years ago, and he had sort of fallen off the radar there in the playoffs. Has, you know, he insists he's healthy, as guys usually do when they haven't been.
Right.
But but I think at least it'll add a little excitement. And, you know, the Falcons would love him to be just even 80-90% of what Todd Gurley can be, because I think that would be a huge boost if we ever get back on the field again, to provide that sort of balance that, you know, made that offense so good that Super Bowl year. You know, that when they had Devontae Freeman and Tevin Coleman and carrying the ball, and that just really opened up the, I think their offense, you know, it's a passing game now in the pros, but you know, if you've got that ability to rush for 100 to 120 yards a game consistently, that really opens up the passing game when you have, you know, Matt Ryan and Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley. Yes, sure. And that was what was so beautiful about that offense in that 2016 season. It's just that, just like, no matter what you tried to take away from them, they had another weapon. And that's, you know,
that's right.
As an offense, no matter what kind of offense you run, that's what you're looking for. That, you know, if you're doubling and tripling Julio, they got other guys that can beat you and other ways to beat you. So it'll be very, you know, I'd love to get the football season started sort of on time and see what Todd Gurley still has in the tank.
Yeah, see what he has left. So last but not least, we are going to have a 2020 Summer Olympics. It's just going to be in the summer of 2021. And I know that you are
hopefully.
On the AP. Let's add hopefully.
You are
always on the AP's Olympics team. And in the summer you're doing swimming, which of course is one of the really premier assignments. What does delaying this thing a year do? And, I mean, I guess age is the athlete's greatest adversary, but we don't think that a year is really going to harm any of the of the top champions, do we?
I do not. I don't think this is like the 80 boycott, you know, where guys lost their one and only chance, maybe for an Olympics. Not only that, was a different era too, where a lot of those guys were true amateurs who just couldn't afford to, you know, stick around. They were, you know, they'd basically gone into poverty for their shot at the Olympics and, you know, had real jobs lined up. That's not necessarily the case, at least in the top sports, you know, track and swimming now, where people can stay in it for, you know, basically an athletic career, like any other athlete and make a decent
4 or 5 cycles.
Yeah, they're not making baseball money, but, you know, you can make the top level people with sponsorships and stuff are making, you know, a pretty comfortable living that allows them to keep doing what they love. And so I don't think a year, I don't know. There's a handful of people probably in every sport and swimming included, that guys that are, you know, and women who are getting a little up against it in age and maybe a year, you know, maybe they were really – you know, we do know that sometimes the way these things work in all of athletics, you kind of peak at a certain time that won't be, you know, won't be at that peak in a year from now, no matter,
right,
you know, how much they train or how well they train and no injuries or whatever. But, you know, again, they didn't, you know, it's pretty obvious now they had no choice except to do that. And, I mean, we've even heard some doubts with, you know, some of the virus sort of breaking out a bit now in Japan. They've had kind of a surge in infections here in the last couple of weeks that I believe one of their organizers, you know, even kind of said, you know, nothing's for sure. You know, we certainly are planning for 2021, but you know, if we're still kind of in the midst of this, that could even be in doubt. But let's just say we're for sure we're going to have us an Olympics next year. And I don't think it's going to be. I was talking to Bob Bowman, who was Michael Phelps' coach for all those years and all those successes. And he said, you know, what's probably hurts is some of the people that, you know, we don't cover and, you know, only family and friends know about, but maybe the athlete who was just finishing college this year and probably didn't have a chance to make the Olympics, but was going to the Olympic trials and then was going to go start their real job, you know, in the fall, they may miss their chance to, you know, go to the trials because they simply can't afford to, you know, put off going to work and trying to stick around for another year, you know, when they don't really probably have the Olympics in their future. So I think this decision to delay probably is more of those stories than it is, you know, top level athletes. But there will definitely be different gold medal winners in 2021 than there would have probably been in 2020. I just think, you know, there were probably people that were really would have been at their peak this year. And, you know, even if they keep training and all goes well, who won't necessarily, the body is a strange thing, that won't be at that next year. And, you know, we'll never know the answers to that, but I think it certainly makes it different.
Well, Phelps actually goes the other way. He doesn't age. He actually subtracts every year. So maybe this will get him back in the pool. And
I did. I talked to him recently and I was like, you know, now you got an extra year. Let's get back to training. And he just laughs. I think he's now up to 3 kids under the age of 5. So, you know, even though I think they have some help around the house, and he was, when I talked to him, he was hunkered down at home and I heard a lot of screaming in the background. So I think, yeah, he's got his hands full right now.
I think, yeah, he's moved on.
You know, our hopes of a comeback. Yeah. I don't think are going to be realized.
Well, Paul, thanks as always. And good luck filling your days. I know that.
Yes, it's interesting.
I know you like to be busy, and this isn't helping.
You do realize, you know, all those times you complained about having to go to games and some Wednesday night, you know, seemingly meaningless college basketball game or NBA game, you know, and you're going, you know, what I would give for it right now, for sure.
That's a wrap on the Wednesday commute. Thanks to our guests, Bryn Grant with the United Way of the Coastal Empire and the Associated Press and sports writer, Paul Newberry. Also, thank you to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Please support National Office Systems as they support this podcast. If you've missed a recent episode of The Commute, or even a not-so-recent episode, you can find our archives at savannahnow.com/podcasts or by searching The Commute with @SavannahOpinion on your favorite podcast app. Earlier this week, we had an episode that featured Savannah Mayor Van Johnson. Pretty fascinating stuff. The Commute returns on Friday. Thank you for listening.